This is J. Gary Sparks, December 7th, 2012. Uniting Spirit and Matter. Carl Jung and Wolfgang Pauli in Dialogue. There were a few images on this DVD recording, and the DVD is available in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
I want to share briefly how I first became aware of Gary Sparks' work. In 2010, while living in Port Townsend, rebuilding my life after the death of my husband, I had a dream that so shook me that I really have never been the same since. At the time, I knew nothing about dream study nor about psychology, but I knew I had to try to understand this dream. A Google search revealed a small society called Jung in Port Townsend, and that they were sponsoring a workshop led by a Jungian analyst from Indiana named Gary Sparks. The workshop, scheduled for the following weekend, would be held at the local Unitarian Church, just blocks from where I lived. At the time, I did not know enough to appreciate how rare such a workshop is, nor how fortunate I was to have Gary Sparks be my first introduction to the ideas of Carl Jung. Today, I think it one of the more beneficent synchronicities in my life. During that weekend, while I had little intellectual background with which to understand the richness of Gary's presentation, I knew that I was in the presence of ideas that mattered, ideas that would be deeply important to me for the rest of my life. For the first time, I was in the company of people who allowed dreams to inform and direct their waking lives. For instance, I learned that it was a dream that inaugurated Gary Sparks' own research and book about the work of Jung and Pauli. And when I managed to venture my extremely simplistic questions, Gary treated me with a patience and kindness and attentiveness that I have never forgotten. Since then, I have remarried and relocated to Seattle, and thus had the chance to become a member here. When Tom Wilkinson, our program committee chair, asked if I would introduce Gary this evening, I felt honored to have this opportunity to thank Gary for the experience he gave me in the fall of 2010, and to thank the Seattle Jung Society for bringing Gary back. I am certain that a real feast of potent ideas and experiences awaits us tonight and tomorrow. Gary's own journey is a fascinating one. He grew up in Pennsylvania and received his BS in electrical engineering from Bucknell University. He then traveled to South Korea with the Peace Corps, teaching English as a foreign language and methods of science education for primary school teachers there. Upon returning to the U.S., Gary taught at a private school for emotionally disturbed adolescents in California and earned his Master of Divinity and Master of Arts in Pastoral Counseling at the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley. He then went to Zurich, teaching at the commercial high school there while earning his diploma in analytical psychology at the C.G. Jung Institute. His thesis, titled The Wounded Finger, Anchorage for Soul and Sense in Technology, deals with the psychology of creativity in science and the bearing of scientific creativity on unconscious processes. Marie-Louise von Franz served as his thesis advisor. Upon receiving his diploma in 1982, Gary had a dream that he would open his practice in Indianapolis, the last major city in the U.S. that had no practicing Jungian analyst to serve the population. Prior to the dream, his connection to the area involved an incident in 1968, during which Gary was almost beaten up in an Indianapolis bar for having long hair. But true to the dream, Gary moved to Indianapolis upon leaving Zurich, and he has been in private practice there ever since. In addition to his analytical practice, Gary is a gifted teacher and has offered a wide range of Jung courses and workshops at places like Indiana University Purdue, University of Vermont, and the analyst training program at the C.G. Jung Foundation in Ontario, Canada. He is editor of Edward Edinger's Ego and Self, The Old Testament Prophets, and co-editor with Daryl Sharp of Edinger's Science of the Soul. Gary is the author of two important books for anyone attempting to understand Jung's ideas regarding synchronicity, and The Image of Number in the Collective Psyche. At the Heart of Matter, Synchronicity and Jung's Spiritual Testament was published in 2007, followed by Valley of Diamonds, Adventures in Number and Time with Marie-Louise von Franz, which came out in 2010. Both titles, published by Inner City Books, are happily for us available for sale here tonight at the table in the back. I am thrilled about that. Finally, it would not be right to call your attention to Gary's gifts as teacher and author without mentioning his truly wonderful website. The website represents an extremely generous treasure trove of recommended readings, YouTube offerings, and course materials, and I plan to spend some of 2013 working through what is available there. If you join me in such an endeavor, you will see that this short introduction has barely scratched the surface of the many creative interests and authentic investigations that have occupied Gary over the first 30 years of his career. Thus, it is a great honor to invite you to join me in warmly welcoming Gary Sparks to Seattle.
Things fall apart. The center cannot hold, wrote William Butler Yeats in 1919. Giving voice to a sentiment at the foundation of Jung's psychology that we are living in a time of immense psychological transition. This period of transition began with World War I. World War I showed us the limits of Enlightenment thinking, the limits of the church, the limits of science in creating a sane world. Out of the despair of the bloodbath of World War I, and its sibling, World War II, the guiding power of religion has been almost universally contested by thinking and feeling persons. Where was God in all the carnage? So Nietzsche's God is dead is paramount here. The despair has raised further questions. What will replace the guidance the church has provided for the last 2,000 years? Hiroshima and Nagasaki soon shattered the conviction that we live in a secure world and that the powers of science would only be used benevolently. Additionally, the computer and the internet's impact on human communication has shattered the world, has shattered our security in the world, and has shrunk the size of the globe to the point where what happens on one side of the world is seconds away from our knowledge of it, and the assault of information on an overwhelmed leader who makes a wrong decision could end in serious consequences. Also, there's the fragility of the Earth that is increasingly staring us in the face. The 20th and the 21st centuries have brought change at an astounding rate, and this in turn places a responsibility on us to live consciously and humanly with that change. How must we develop in order to meet the challenges that the last 100 years have placed on us? Tonight, as an attempt to answer that question, I would like to look at the creative responses to the birth of our new and complicated age on the part of two persons, psychologist Carl Gustav Jung and nuclear physicist Wolfgang Pauli. The work of these two researchers represents, I submit to you, a portrait of how we need to change, what we need to understand in order to assure that life continues without catastrophe in the centuries ahead. I need not explain why I include Jung's name here, but you might wonder why Pauli's. I'll be addressing that question as we go along. Let's take a look at the lives of Jung and Pauli, and then consider the extent and importance of their friendship. I'd like to just give you a very brief overview of the lives of these two men, which I'll fill in as I go along. I'll be mentioning some terms you might not be familiar with initially, but I'll be following those threads throughout the evening. Of course, you all know Jung, I'm sure. I find it helpful to break Jung's life up into four different periods. He was born in 1875, and from 1875 to 1913, he went to the university. He became a doctor. He became a psychiatrist. He worked in his residency at the Burgholzli Mental Hospital in Zurich. Met Freud, became a Freudian analyst, and in 1913, Freud and Jung split. So by 1913, he became a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst. With the loss of support of Freud's more experienced guidance and the loss of feeling he had any mentor to lead him further into understanding how this psychology business works, he went into a period of a night sea journey, I call it, or a creative pregnancy, in which he wrote the Red Book. He examined his dreams and his fantasies, recorded them meticulously, and discovered something. That something will be one of the threads we talk about tonight, that there is an inborn healing process that comes in each person and works in them through life. One of the things that he recognized, which puzzled him initially, was this process does not work causally, where the Freudian method looks at everything in our life as having been caused by some past experience. Jung's recognition was this healing process gets going under certain circumstances, which we'll talk about, but nothing in your past explains the way this thing works. He wondered, can this be? Have I discovered a principle that violates all the laws of physics? This doesn't fit in the idea that one event causes another. That period ended in 1928 when he felt more confident that he had discovered something and he could begin speaking publicly about what he discovered. From 1928, where he got his feet back on the ground, where, as I like to put it, Jung became Jung, his ideas were pretty much formalized by that point. His next period from 1928 to 1944, I call his nuts and bolts period. He simply took that basic idea of the inborn healing process and documented it in essays, in lectures, and communicated the basic principle he had discovered. What is unique about these writings is he really makes an effort at this point to present the material in a way that does not offend the reader. He wrote from 1928 to 1944 with the needs of the reader in mind. Those writings are fairly accessible. 1944 started the last phase of Jung's life. He had a heart attack. He almost died. He said to himself when he recovered, well, I could be dead. So I'm now going to write not from the point of view of the needs of the reader, but from the point of view of the needs of the material. His last works are the most difficult. He wrote on the psychology of alchemy. We'll be talking about alchemy. He wrote on the psychology of history. He wrote a very important essay called Answer to Job, where he examines the nature of evil and injustice. And For our purposes tonight, he wrote his essay on synchronicity. These works are more difficult to grasp because he says, well, you guys do the work. I am being true to the material. The reader has to make an effort. What we'll be doing tonight, then, is looking particularly at his work on synchronicity. But that's the background of Jung's development and how the different phases of his life all reflect in his writings a slightly different texture. Now, Wolfgang Pauli. Likewise with Pauli, I find it helpful to divide his life up into four different periods, just to kind of characterize the different phases of his development. Wolfgang Pauli was born in 1900 in Vienna. From 1900 until 1927, he became a quantum physicist. He went to university in Munich. When he finished the university in Munich, he worked in a couple of different physics institutes around Germany. In 1922, he was invited to work with Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg in Copenhagen, and these guys were the ones that were trying to understand the inner workings of the atom. It's their work then that became the quantum interpretation of the quantum interpretation of physics. From joining the group then in 1922, Pauli made his significant contribution to physics in 1925. Which is called the Pauli exclusion principle. That's not really important for our purposes. But what it was a very important missing piece about the nature of how these electrons work in an atom that allowed the research to be finalized in 1927. So by 1927, he had become a world-renowned physicist, one of the three contributors to the physics that has made the nuclear weapons possible, nuclear energy possible. We wouldn't have cell phones without quantum mechanics. A date to remember is 1913. That's when Niels Bohr's group started. Niels Bohr's group in Copenhagen began the work on the atom in 1913. Pauli didn't join it until 1922. 1927, he's famous, and was offered Einstein's chair of physics at the University of Zurich, and fell into a personal crisis pretty quickly. He married and divorced within about a year. His mother committed suicide. He began drinking, getting into bar fights. This is no way for a Herr professor in a Germanic university to behave. And so by 1932, he was in Jung's consulting room. So I call that second period his period of crisis. Jung said to him, you know what your problem is? Your problem is women, and referred him out to a female analyst. After about a year, Pauli got his feet back on the ground and continued working with her on and off. But within a year or so, he was back in a stable condition. From 1932 to 1946 was his nuts and bolts period. He continued working, doing physics research, until 1940. In 1940, the Germans were amassing just above Zurich on the Swiss border, and as far as the Swiss knew, there was an impending invasion. Pauli was living in Zurich with an Austrian passport. Austria was already under Nazi domination. If the Nazis had invaded Switzerland, then Pauli would have been a goner. So he fled Switzerland and moved to Princeton, where he worked at the Institute for Advanced Studies with Einstein. He and Einstein became very good friends. A little anecdote just to give you a little comic relief in all this material. Niels Bohr, I guess you could say the daddy of this quantum mechanics stuff, was visiting Pauli one day, and they were discussing matters of physics and probably politics, as we'll see. When the door squeaked open, and Einstein snuck around the back of the office to Pally's tobacco jar and rattled the glass as he was lifting it, and Pally said, "Albert, what are you doing?" And Einstein said, "Well, my doctor said I can't buy any more tobacco, but he didn't say I couldn't steal it." Pally then worked in Princeton till the end of the war, but really faced a dilemma with the beginnings of the Manhattan Project. Pally was the only physicist who refused to work on it. He said it wasn't the business of science to engineer mass destruction. His student, Robert Oppenheimer, was the leader of that project. When the bombs went off over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Pally got very depressed. He felt that science had contributed to a development that was never foreseen in his mind, with a mass destruction and a future capacity for even more destruction, and was terribly disturbed about this development. He said, "I know it's not rational that I feel this way, but I have lost my love of science, and I have lost my ability to be creative in science." So he became depressed at the end of the war, and also was very disgusted in what he felt was the military, the marriage between military and science, that American science had just become an arm of the military-industrial complex, and he went back to Switzerland. He went back to Switzerland depressed and went to see Jung again. Now we're coming more into why we're talking about him tonight. He went to Jung this time not as a patient. He was functioning okay. But he went to Jung with his distress. And from 1946, when he returned to Zurich, until 1958 and his death, he and Jung worked on Pally's dreams, which are a response to Pally's suffering over the world situation. That's one of the things we'll be doing tonight, looking at those dreams. It was a professional friendship. They would meet for lunch or a beer. Pally would meet Jung down in Balingen, and they carried on a lively correspondence. These dreams, I feel, are one of the most important documents of the soul, maybe second only to the Red Book, as to a glimpse to deep into the collective unconscious, what is moving our time, what is really going on. And as I say, we'll be looking at those dreams. A couple of things I'd like you to observe. First of all, Jung's night sea journey in Zurich, which led to psychology in the period 1913 to 28, and the years of research in Copenhagen, which led to quantum mechanics from 1913 to 1927, exactly overlap. We're going to see a real similarity in their discoveries, one in the physical world, one in the psychological world, and my feeling is one unique new worldview was surfacing in two different places at the same time. Also observe that Pally, the quantum physicist, entered Jung's life just as he was getting his feet on the ground, just as Jung was becoming Jung, just as his ideas about the inborn and non-causally explainable healing process was finalized. Jung could recognize through Pally that non-causal was becoming a respectable scientific principle because quantum physics also threw out causality as being an invalid principle to explain many of the aspects of subatomic particles. What Jung discovered about the inner healing process did not conflict with the known laws of science after his acquaintance with Pally, and this was very important to Jung. Pally entered Jung's life again in 1946, just as Jung was beginning his major writing. Pally brought Jung profound collective problems, the state of the world, particularly the destructive power of science and technology, which were reflected in Pally's dreams, and which coincided with Jung's decision to write what would be his major works. Synchronicity was on both men's mind. Pally's support was crucial in Jung's decision to publish on these acausal coincidences. Well, that's the background. Now I would like to look at the accomplishments of these pioneers in a little more detail and to try to lay out how the work of each of these pioneers inspired the other and look at the points where their lives crossed. Let's look at the first creative phase of Jung's life. As I mentioned, his Night Sea journey, or his creative pregnancy, or as also like to put it, his soul became pregnant with the 21st century in the 19th century. What he discovered was this inborn healing process. What is that? What he discovered is when we fall apart, when life has become too much, either for inner reasons or outer reasons, if we pay attention to and get to know all the various parts of ourselves, or all the various forces in ourselves, or all the various and often conflicting points of view of our inner dream figures, if we really hear them and own up to what they are about, of course, as I mentioned, Jung's Red Book is a marvelous record of this in Jung's own life. If we do this, Jung recognized, the psyche responds by showing us images of our deepest self, which contain all the parts we have been facing. Another way to put it is that those images represent our center, which both contains and resolves the conflicting parts we have endured during our confusion. This would be a good time to explain one of the words in my title tonight, the spirit. Jung's idea is if we pay attention to the unconscious, it responds by showing us the images that we need to move forward. And as we understand one image, the next image that comes along is a step ahead of the previous image, and the image-producing capacity of the psyche can guide us forward. This guidance through images, which we see in our conscious field of vision, coming up from the dreams, is what Jung means by spirit. I'd like to give you a taste of the dream he had near the end of his Night Sea journey as this healing process with its goal of the production of the self was becoming clear to him. In the dream, he was in Liverpool walking with some Swiss friends on an awfully dark and dreary day. The streets of the city were arranged radially out from the center square of the city. In the square was a pool, and in that pool, a small island. Now I'm going to quote from Jung's memories directly. Well, everything round about was obscured by rain, fog, smoke, and dimly lit darkness, the little island blazed with sunlight. On it stood a single tree, a magnolia, in a shower of reddish blossom. My companions commented on the abominable weather and obviously did not see the tree. They spoke of another Swiss who was living in Liverpool and expressed surprise that he should have settled there. I thought, I know very well why he has settled here. Here's the picture Jung drew of that dream. You can see the drawing is streets radially. You can't quite see it very clearly, but in the center is that magnolia. The magnolia at the center of the picture is an image of the self I just mentioned. This image of our broader and deeper personality, this image of the center, the self which resolves conflict, is presented to us. This is the key word. It is presented to us spontaneously by the unconscious. We discover ourselves through the dream images, then we create ourselves through the guidance of the image or images we have just discovered. Consciousness of the self restores orientation to our disorientation as we integrate these changes into our lifestyle and redirect our lives accordingly with more hard work. One of the very important facts here is that Jung's observation that the healing process cannot be explained that cannot be explained causally by the past. You can see where he split with Freud on this. Everything for Freud is caused. Became his central idea. Jung throws out determinative causality in explaining the working of the healing process. This process is teleological, which means goal-directed, and the nature of the healing process isn't causal, but teleological. I don't know if you know that word. Teleology means goal-directed. It comes from the Greek word telos. So Jung throws out causality as being important for what heals us and puts in its place teleology, that this healing process has an intelligence of its own which leads us forward. The dynamism central to the healing process does not follow old causal ideas which have been central to physics for nearly 300 years. Now his second creative period. Remember the second period from 1944 to 1961. I referred to a couple of the ideas that he worked on, primarily the psychology of alchemy. I'm not sure everyone knows what this would refer to, so I will briefly mention. Alchemists were medieval pre-chemists who thought they were transforming some piece of material in a flask into gold. And as they did that, they recorded their observations not in chemical symbols, but in mythological images. Jung then studied all their writings as a metaphor for what happens when we face the undesirable parts of ourselves and, in time, follow their transformation into something valuable. He wrote his book, Ion, which is a study of history, Answer to Job, I mentioned, and, for our purposes tonight, Synchronicity. Well, I'm not sure you all are familiar with synchronicity, so I would like to tell you the most astounding synchronicity I've ever seen. I was working with a woman who was about 40, and she had dreams of being gang raped. Now, dreams like that can either refer to an objective event, or they can be a metaphor for something in the personality attacking the dreamer. Probing her past, there was no sexual abuse, there had not been such an objective event, so we concentrated on its inner meaning as a metaphor for something in her attacking her and wanting to have entrance into her intimate sphere of life. Over time, that gang rape theme became a rape by one man. Over more time, that one man turned out to be her first boyfriend. She told me the following story. She was 16 and fell in love. Her mother, who was a nutcase, said, "If you continue seeing the boy, I'm going to kill myself." She broke off the relationship. 20 years later, she was married, not particularly unhappily, as happy as anybody, and yet had these dreams of some injury from the past. So I said, "My guess is there's some real unfinished business between you and this fellow. I'll call him Fred. There's some real unfinished business between you and Fred. We've got to figure out what that is. Why don't you go back to your home part of town and see if you can find him, see if anyone knows where he is?" Well, she did. And she came back and she said, "No, no one's seen him or heard from him since high school." I said, "Well, not to worry. We've seen how the dreams evolve." You see, that's the spirit. We've seen how the dreams evolve, getting more and more clear. I suspect they will continue evolving, and they will tell us what we need to know is unfinished about this guy. Well, she came back the next week, white as a ghost. And she said, "Guess who called? From Oregon after 20 years. All he said was, 'Hi, this is Fred. I'm going to be in Indianapolis next week. We have some things to talk about.'" She said, "We sure do." They met. They talked. She realized what she had admired about him so much was his intelligence and discipline. She never went to college and never even felt she could do that, not for financial reasons, but she didn't feel she was smart enough to do it. But with that experience, we could see how she was projecting her intelligence onto this guy. and resolved then to apply to the university. She did, got her degree, the dream stopped. That's an example of a synchronicity, where the inner image plays itself out in the outer world. Now, the reason you may not realize you're having these things, and they don't happen that often, maybe once a month. Some people say, oh, I've had 7 synchronicities today. I doubt it. But they do occur, but you have to know what's going on inside of yourself. So the synchronicity here is where inner images and outer material events operate together and matter functions symbolically. See, we could ask ourselves, where was that dream? We could have easily expected the next dreams to reflect who he was, but the information about who he was came in the outer world. So the dream isn't only limited to the inner world. This is one of the facts Jung had to face in his work on synchronicity. This, by the way, is a good time to define the other term in my topic tonight, matter. By matter, I mean the material world, events in the material world. It could be a physical object. Sometimes you dream of a physical object and you come across the physical object within a day or so in a way that completely defeats probability. I was talking earlier with some folks. Example, a woman dreams of a bear claw. And we talked about the bear as an animal that can swat. The woman was quite passive in life and realized that that dream showed her she needed to be more aggressive. The next day, she's at the fabric store. She looks over the shoulder. A woman standing in front of her has a handful of buttons embossed with bear claws. Either an event with another person or a material object, when it repeats the image that we've seen from the inside, we're talking about a synchronicity, and that's what we mean by matter. So that when matter operates symbolically, an event in the physical world carries the same significance as a dream image. So not only inner images, which what I defined as spirit, but also outer reality or matter, act non-causally, teleologically. Synchronistic moments are moments in time when the spirit, inner images, and matter, events in the outer world, are united. Now, I have a short clip of Jung talking about this. I thought you would enjoy hearing what he has to say. It's about an 8-minute clip. Jung talks about the work of Joseph Banks Rhine. So I've spliced a little bit about Rhine's work at the beginning, just so you have a clue what I'm talking about. But the real purpose is to give you a chance to hear Jung talking about this. And if Murphy cooperates...
Only 50 years ago at Duke University, researchers began developing better methods for gathering evidence of ESP. The earliest laboratory work on psychic phenomena was done here at the Institute for Parapsychology. The Institute, which is now an independent research center, was established by a former botanist, Joseph Banks Rhine. In his studies, Rhine used these 5 distinctive cards. With cards, he could use statistics to assess the results of his experiments. In this unique archive film of a typical test, the subject had to guess the order of a pack of 25 cards dealt face down by the experimenter. She pointed to each symbol to indicate her guess.
There.
When the experiment was over, the experimenter counted up the number of correct guesses.
Find out what your score was. You got 1 circle.
To find out if she was psychic, Rhine used the 3 standard crosses. Laws of chance.
2 waves.
The pack of 25 cards contained 5 lots of 5 separate symbols. Statistically, over a long series of tests, she should have guessed 5 cards right by chance.
9, 10, 11. That's marvelous. 6, 1.
But one experiment proved nothing. Rhine did thousands of trials on hundreds of people. This one tested the power of mind over matter to affect the fall of dice.
5, 1. 2, 1.
Prolonged testing was essential because for statistical proof, they needed consistent scores well above chance. Another experiment examined foretelling the future. The subject had to list the five symbols in the order in which she thought the experimenter would list them after the test. A table of random numbers determined the order in which he put his list.
This is a very good score. You would expect a score of 5 by chance, but you have a score of 11. So that's really very fine.
Ryan identified 4 psychic abilities: telepathy, mind-to-mind communication, clairvoyance, seeing things at a distance, precognition, knowing the future. These he called extrasensory perception. On its own, psychokinesis, moving things at a distance. To describe all 4 abilities, Ryan coined the term psi. He said there was firm proof for 3 of them.
We can say that clairvoyance, the precognition, and PK, a moving target, are in this very firm category. It begins to look as though the capacity, psi capacity in general, including ESP and PK, is a natural property, natural capacity.
Now I'm going to say something which in these sacred rooms is an anathema. relativation of time and space through the psyche. And that's the fact. And that is what Ryan has made evident.
Yeah.
Now swallow that.
Well,
that's difficult. Yeah.
Well, may I go a little further and per some of your recent work, which is indeed very profound, and it is not too well known to many of our students as yet.
Of course not.
And of course this
nobody
is...
reads these things. Only the general public.
And,
because my books are at least sold.
I'm referring now to the concept of synchronicity, which you have discussed.
Yeah.
And which would have some relevance at this point in our discussion. Would you care to comment a little bit on this concept?
That is awfully complicated. One wouldn't know where to begin. Of course, it is this kind of thinking has been started long ago. And when Ryan brought out these results, I thought now we have at least a more or less dependable basis to argue on, you know. But the argument was not understood at all, because it's really very, very difficult. You know, there are plenty of facts in the observation of the unconscious where you come across cases of a very peculiar kind of parallel events, namely that, say, I have a certain thought or a certain definite subject is occupying my attention or my interest. At the same time, something else, quite independently, happens that portrays just that thought.
Yes.
Now, this is utter nonsense, you know, looked at from a causal point of view. That it is not nonsense is made evident by the results of Ryan's experiments. There is a probability, it is something more than chance, that such a case occurs. Now I have, I never made statistical experiments,
yeah,
to, except one, in the way of Ryan. I have made one for another purpose. But I have come across quite a number of cases where it was most astounding to find that two causal chains happened at the same time, but independent upon each other, so that you could say they have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
Of course, it's quite clear. For instance, just so I speak of a red car, and at that moment a red car comes here, you see.
Yes.
Now, I haven't seen it. It was impossible because it was behind the building. In this moment, the red car appears. Now, this is, that's mere chance. The Reis experiment proves that these cases are not mere chances. Of course, many of these things are occurrences where we cannot apply such an argument, otherwise we would be superstitious. We can't say, now this car has appeared because here was some remarks have been made about the red car.
Yes. It's not cause and effect.
Oh, this is a miracle that the red car appears. It is not, it is chance.
Yes.
It's just chance. But these chances happen more often than chance allows.
Yes.
And that shows that there is something behind it.
Yes.
So you see, in the Rhein has a whole institute and with many co-workers.
Yes.
And has the means. We have no means here, you know, and I had no means to make such experiments, otherwise I probably would have done them. But it was physically impossible. So I had to content myself with the observation of facts.
The key phrase there, of course, is the chances that happen more often than chance. And these moments characterize those times when spirit and matter work in tandem. I'd like to now run by you a vision Jung had while reflecting on these issues later in his life. He woke one night and saw a vision of Christ at the foot of his bed. He saw that Christ's body was made of greenish gold. He then wrote, and now I quote, "The green gold is the living quality which the alchemists saw in inorganic matter. The emphasis on the metal showed me the undisguised alchemical conception of Christ as a union of spiritually alive and physically dead matter." So what he's realizing is there is a living quality to matter, which shows us guidance along the way of our psychological journeys. This guidance appears in, quote, chance events, but chance events which are more than chance, and which clearly contain meaning for the orientation and direction of our lives. We'll see that Pauli supported this and why, and we'll see the importance of this not only to Jung, but also to us personally and socially. Look at Wolfgang Pauli's major accomplishments. Remember, he's got two major creative periods, the one ending with the discovery of quantum mechanics in 1927. I thought I'd give you a quick quantum mechanics 101. Quantum physicists were trying to solve the problem of light. If you've played with a prism as a kid, you know, when you hold a prism up to the sunlight, you get a rainbow of colors. But if you hold a prism up to an energized pure gas, helium, hydrogen, whatever it is, you get not a smear of colors, but a very distinctive lines of color coming off that gas going through a prism. And what these physicists were trying to figure out is, why is that so? Not only are the bands of light predictable, but their relative intensity to each other is also constant. What they discovered, here shining the light of a pure gas through a prism and getting their it's called light signature in its technical word, getting the light signature of a gas, is that when a atom receives a burst of energy, the electrons in the atom jump up an energy level, and when the energy level is taken away, the electron falls back to its original orbit. And depending on how far that electron travels up and back, is the reason that light is given off in different color bands. But what is so unique here, even though the light signature of a illuminated gas is constant on the average, for single events, it can never be predicted whether an energized electron will go up 1, 2, 3 orbits directly or stop along the way, or whether an energized electron, once up at its higher level, will fall back directly or will stop along the way. The behavior of the electron can never be predicted from what caused its movement. That's what we mean by the breakdown of causality. It's as if that electron has a mind of its own and is deciding where it will go. Where classical physics says you can predict all movements. You take a bowling ball, hit another bowling ball, you know how fast the first one's going. You can calculate how fast and in what direction the second one is going. That breaks down in quantum physics. And that's what meant so much to Jung to hear from Pauli. You're not off the mark with this non-causal stuff. We're facing the same problem. So Jung received support from Pauli there that his ideas about the non-caused healing process were not in violation of the current physics, thinking in physics. The last period I want to look at a little more closely now. It's when he returned to Zurich in 1946 and discussed his dreams with Jung. He was asking himself, what has gone wrong? What is the nature of humankind that this is the result of our physics research? You know, these guys that developed quantum physics were just grad students playing beer pong, and they came up with this miraculous discovery about the inner workings of the atom, and it's that work then which laid the foundation of the atomic and then eventually the nuclear bombs. Pauli was very distressed. This is where his research had gone. And then took the dreams he had out of this anxious depression to Jung to try to understand from the point of view of the unconscious what is going on. The idea here in Jung's psychology is that when we are suffering over social, cultural, collective problems, the likelihood is increased that our dreams will be a response not to our personal problems, but to the problems of our time. So I'm looking at Pauli's dreams as a glimpse from the point of view of the unconscious, what we need to understand in order to not repeat the destruction that we've carried on up to now. I'll look at three dreams. I think I might have mentioned about 50 have been recorded. They were spread around archives in Zurich and Geneva. Geneva for the, you probably know, the CERN, the Hadron Collider in Geneva, where a lot of Pauli's records ended up. And about 50 have been collected. I'm going to talk about three just for the sake of time, but I would submit to you they're representative of what was going on in Pauli. First dream I want to discuss actually is prior to the date of Pauli's return to Zurich. But I wanted to show you that dream as where Pauli started from. We'll see him saturated with the Western point of view, and then that will be challenged in subsequent dreams. Here's the dream he had in 1938. I call it a dream of time. At the top, there is a window. To the right of it, a clock. In the dream, I draw an oscillation process beneath the window, actually two oscillations, one beneath the other. By turning to the right from the curves, I try to see the time on the clock, but the clock is too high, so that doesn't work. Then the dream continues. The dark, unknown woman appears. She is crying because she wants to write a book but cannot find a publisher for it. In this book, there is apparently a great deal of material on time symbolism. For example, how a period of time is constituted when certain symbols appear in it. At the end of one page of the book, there are the following words read aloud by the voice. The definite hours have to be paid for with the definite life. The indefinite hours have to be paid for with the indefinite life. Well, let's try to interpret that. The window, because it's what we look through to see the world, would probably represent Pali's conscious orientation at this time. The symbol of time next to the window would refer to Pali's conscious understanding of time. At this point, Pali's life was, as I said, saturated with the Western point of view. The clock is divided into three segments. Now, we know in Jungian psychology, when dreams want to stress completeness, they speak in images of four. So the fact that there are three here suggests something is missing from the clock. It's what Pali, and by extension, the Western point of view in general, has not understood about time. This aspect likely has something to do with the two curves drawn under the window and the clock. In a letter to Jung, Pali refers to these lines as an imago Dei, an image of God. God, Pali is saying, manifests in rhythms of time. This would likely refer to kairos, the quality of time, as opposed to chronos, the length of time. Now, you may not know these words. The Greeks had three words for time. Chronos is the space between ticks. Kairos is the quality of the space between the ticks. And ion means a long period of time. Ion is the root of our word eon, obviously. Synchronicity would be these kairos moments, a qualitative moment of time, which at this point, Pali and the West do not understand. In the kairos moments of synchronicity, when chance is more than chance, matter operates symbolically. The dark woman, due to her darkened color, would represent, among other things, the voice of the earth and the soil, not the voice of the intellect. She refers to the definite and indefinite dimensions of the work. The will and intention to face ourselves would be the definite hours, and the kairos moments, or the synchronistic moments, when the fruit of our labor is presented to us, would be the kairos moments. The book she once published would be what Pali was to do. The unconscious voice of the natural and material world makes specific demands. The shift in awareness that the dream announces seeks to educate the general cultural attitudes of our time. Now, the next dream is from 1949. So Pali was back in Zurich, he was suffering, he was talking to Jung, and we're seeing these dreams as a response to that inquiry. I am with colleagues on one of the upper floors of a house where a departmental conference on mathematics and physics is being held. I see that under my name, a course on cooking is announced. Now I notice that a fire has started in the adjacent room. I take fright, run down a staircase along many floors. Finally, I succeed in getting outside. Looking back, I see that two floors of the house where the colleagues were gathered are burnt down. I see that a taxi is waiting for me and that the taxi driver fills the tank with petrol. I look more closely. I recognize him, the light, dark stranger. I look at the stranger. The light, dark stranger. Immediately I feel secure. Probably he has lighted the fire, I think to myself without saying it aloud. He says to me quietly, "Now we can refuel because upstairs there has been a fire. I will take you where you belong." Then he drives me off. Well, the upper floor in the dream would represent at this time that Pali was likely living rationally in his head above the meaning of matter. He understood all this intellectually, but he hadn't begun to live it. The cooking would represent that he was to prepare a new point of view in himself. On the one hand, for himself, and on the other, for our time. The fire would represent the emotional suffering he was enduring at the time. Now the stranger. The stranger was a frequent figure in Pali's dreams. Pali observed that in other dreams, the stranger made it clear he saw no distinction between the physical and the spiritual. In some of his dreams, some of Pali's dreams, the stranger was causing floods, which would represent the stranger was behind the emotional influx that Pali was experiencing. In other dreams, the stranger was seeking admission to the technical university where Pali was teaching. Meaning, this point of view, which is already present in the collective unconscious, wants to be included in the scientific world. Also, Pali would walk into a church, and the stranger would be in the church lecturing on quantum mechanics, suggesting that not only science needs to integrate this point of view, but also religion. So Pali personally and the scientific worldview and the religious worldview needs to come to grips with the teleological function of matter. In a letter to Emma Jung in 1915, Pali compared the stranger to Mercurius, the alchemical Mercurius. Who was Mercurius? Well, there you can see him as a figure which spans the earth, material world, and the heavens, the spiritual world. He's at home in several domains, water, earth, and air. He combines opposite principles. He's got one foot on the sun, one foot on the moon. And he works in and by way of fire. In the alchemist's mind, there was a living spirit in the matter they were trying to transform, and which guided the transformation process of their substances from a base material into this endpoint of gold or diamond or something very valuable. Mercurius is part of both the material and spiritual worlds in the alchemist's mind and is an apt portrayal for the unitary reality I've been discussing that is seeking integration both in science and in religion. The next dream is about a Chinese woman. The Dark One. Remember the Dark One from the first dream. The Dark One is present, and she appears this time quite distinctively as a Chinese woman. She says nothing, but her movements are dance-like, something like a ballet. She is very beautiful, completely dark-haired, small and delicate, and she has almond eyes. She beckons me to follow her and opens a trap door which goes to a floor below. We descend through it. In front of me is an auditorium in which unknown men are sitting. The Chinese woman indicates with hand movements that I should get up onto the rostrum and deliver a lecture. She is pointing upwards with the index finger of her left hand and with the right hand down, something like this. She dances rhythmically back up the steps, through the open door, into the open air, and then back down again, pointing to me on the podium. For her, there is no difference between above and below, I think to myself. As I am actually following her lead and slowly and thoughtfully mounting the podium, I wake up. Well, we've seen the Dark One before. Why Chinese? Probably because the Eastern point of view, which pays attention to the quality of the moment, to the meaning of a time and event, is pressing for integration. The Eastern point of view asks, why is this happening? What is the meaning of this moment and this situation? What is the situation trying to teach me? The Western point of view says, how do I change it? How do I act on it? That's the typical way we've been taught to behave. Also, perhaps in the Chinese meaning, is the idea of the Tao, how to live on earth in harmony with the will of heaven. This is representative of our genuine path in life as we seek to follow the direction given to us by the images of the self. Where the Western way says, where there's a will, there's a way, the Eastern way says, where the way is, the will will follow. The auditorium would suggest, again, Pali is to communicate publicly about this. We saw this in the image of the book in the very first dream. The paradigm shift, whose time it is, has come to receive general recognition and to be integrated not only in Pali's personal life, but also in the life of our times, in the general attitude of our culture. The stranger and the Chinese woman wish a new consciousness for our era. The fact that there's no difference between above and below is, as we've been saying, that the pattern of our life and the events of our life are to be a unity. The plan of our life communicated by our dream images and also by the material world when it acts symbolically is seeking to be one. We can see how forcefully and faithfully Pali's dreams, remember we only saw 3 of 50, but the message of all are quite similar, are pressing for this point of view to be understood in him and to be understood in us. This is the collective unconscious speaking to collective consciousness. The dreams pointed to synchronicity and to a reevaluation of the connection between spirit and matter. This was important to him personally and also to its message for our general outlook on life. This was the second time a physicist had been helpful to Jung. First, confirming that Jung was not off base by talking about non-causality, and that a Nobel laureate of international distinction would recognize the importance of Jung's work and encourage Jung to publish on it, and as actually Jung says to Pali directly, thank you for the inspiration, I will now publish on it, meant a great deal to Jung. Remember that these dreams of Pali's were in response to Pali's questioning, what do we need to understand? Where have we gone wrong? The answer is, we have not yet understood that matter behaves meaningfully. Why is that so important? How is this an answer to the shift in consciousness that needs to occur in our time of transition? Well, a quote from von Franz's last book, Clearing of Enigmas, I think says it very concisely. Technology presupposes that matter has no will of its own, that it is dead and therefore can be handled by man. On the other hand, the point of view that Jung and Pali have clarified forms the basis of a new understanding of the material world and our connection to it. This puts us in relation to the world, not in a position of control and power, not in a position that tries to dominate the material world. Our culture is one in which you take charge of your life, you learn the habits of highly effective people, and you come up with a plan and you implement that plan and you realize the goals which you have consciously set for yourself. On the other hand, the point of view that Jung and Pali have clarified forms the basis of a new understanding of ourselves, of recognizing the limits of intention and willpower in the way we affect the world. Certainly much intention and willpower are necessary as we begin to face ourselves along the inner journey. But the emergence of our true individuality, of the genuine path to walk, the birth of true self-confidence is presented to us and we receive it. We have seen in the example of synchronicity how the world influences us and relativizes our sense of being in charge of everything. It teaches us. In psychological jargon, an appreciation of the meaning of synchronicity relativizes the ego. A relativized ego does not see itself as always the boss, but open to and receptive to guidance from the spirit in matter. In the work of Jung and Pali, we have a glimpse of a new era that is seeking birth in our time. I would like to close with an example which illustrates this and which pertains to community life. Recall Pali's despair after World War II sought an answer for both him personally and the world community. This example refers to the work of one of our Zurich analysts, Theodor Apt. As a young student at the Jung Institute, he was also a student at the Technical University and was getting his PhD in urban and rural development. And his assignment at the Technical University was to go to a small village region in the Alps and statistically do their research to find the best way to invest 5 million francs to help this village with its economic growth. Theodor Apt was also a student at the Jung Institute at this time. And while he was in this village, spending free afternoons just walking around the valleys, and in the evening having a cigar and a glass of wine with the local farmers in the Gasthaus, or the pub restaurant, he began dreaming of the Black Madonna. Now, who's the Black Madonna? In some cathedrals, Catholic cathedrals, and smaller churches in Europe, the Madonna is actually black, physically black. And those places are usually places of physical healing. Lourdes, the Madonna is black. If you've been to Switzerland, the little town outside of Zurich called Einsiedeln has a Madonna who's black. And when you walk in, you see on both sides of the cathedral crutches of those who have been healed by her. So he wondered why he was dreaming of the Black Madonna. Well, on one afternoon, he walked up this rather desolate valley where there was only a few farms and stumbled on a chapel. In the chapel was a Black Madonna. The inner, outer. Well, this really puzzled him. So as he gained the confidence of the farmers in their evening cigar and beer or wine or whatever they were doing, the farmers told him, you know, when our souls are heavy, we don't go to the priest. Now, we don't talk about this because we like the priest, but we don't go to him. When we're suffering, we go to the mountain valley and pray to the Black Madonna in the little chapel. Now, statistically speaking, this was exactly the valley that Apt's statistical research said should be shut down. It was an isolated valley, and the statistical research said the best way to spend that 5 million francs is to move the farmers in that valley to a more developed valley, so you have that infrastructure already there, and then put that 5 million francs into developing the infrastructure of the more populous valley. But what Apt realized, if he did that, that would be a direct insult to the emotions and spiritual life of this village. And while it may technically lead to a bigger chance of efficiency, it would so demoralize these religious people that the effect would be nullified. So he wrote up his dissertation for the Technical University, and at his dissertation defense, he presented part one and part two. Part one said, close this valley and put the money here. Part two, based on his dreams, he said, no, keep this valley open. It is not economically efficient, but to not do so will have an adverse effect on the emotions and spiritual life of these people. Now, one of the reasons I like Switzerland so much is, you know what his dissertation committee said? Oh, let's forget about the statistical stuff. Let's talk about these dreams. And they then developed an economic plan based on the dreams that Apt had about keeping that less developed valley open because of its emotional significance. So in a synchronistic sense, there was the dream, there was the chapel and the discovery, and then the event in the Gasthaus, and then the change of how to spend those 5 million francs. The objective reality of a community out there in the real world was anticipated in Theodor Apt's dreams, and this brought him to the recognition of the emotional and spiritual nature and needs of the village he was investigating. He did not take his, quote, scientific idea and manipulate the village with it. The world, as it were, spoke to him and guided him to relate to it, not to dominate it. Taking account of the souls of its inhabitants, here we can see how we can move beyond the personal confines of our personal life to affect the life of an entire community. Relationship replaces dominance. We don't act on the outer world. We act with the outer world, recognizing that the outer material world has purposes of its own. This is surely one of the prime factors we must learn in our time of transition. A quick sum up, and then we'll take a break. What I presented to you tonight was the idea that we are in a time of transition. We looked at that in the work of Jung and Pauli, both seeing how causal thinking must give way to teleological thinking, and also both recognizing the spiritual power of matter. One idea had surfaced in two different places. The recognition of the limits of willpower, the recognition that there are dynamics in us and matter which can guide us, appears to be an integral part of the transition that we have to make, both on a personal and a social level, in order to face the challenges of the 21st century and surely beyond. Thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.